Hi, my name is Matt Eberhard. I'm a wildlife filmmaker and cinematographer, and you are listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions, and this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, we discuss wildlife cinematography with Matt Eberhard, director of photography for the Netflix series, Our Planet. Learn how Matt spent weeks in the thick, swampy jungle, the logistics of wildlife cinematography, his workflow while in the jungle, and the dangers he faced, plus advice for aspiring wildlife filmmakers. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge Dot Video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and Premium Beat. Well, today is all about wildlife cinematography. I don't know if any of you guys out there do this professionally or just on an amateur level, but it is a completely different workflow than we're used to, at least I'm used to, in the commercial filmmaking industry. I mean, wow. The stories that you're going to hear from Matt are unlike anything we've heard on this show, and I am so excited to share it with you. I mean, he spent 6 weeks in the jungle for some of the projects that he's done for Our Planet. And then, you know, the dangers that he faced. I mean, just think about it. You're out in the wild all day, all night. Just the elements are impossible to deal with. You know, you have to have all your equipment with you and all the weight of that. And he has an extremely small crew because you can't be loud and you really can't be seen by these animals. So it's absolutely amazing what he has done to create the visuals that are presented to us on Our Planet. And whether you watch the show or not, this episode is general enough that you can enjoy it and learn from it regardless. But you should be watching the show because it's awesome. And again, it's called Our Planet on Netflix. But before we get to Matt's interview, I want to take a quick moment and talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment, but they also have these things called pub nights. Now, these are free events. They're called pub nights because they have pizza and beer for free that you guys can enjoy. All you have to do is show up, and the event is free too. But aside from the pizza and beer and good conversation with your production peers, you're always going to learn something. And on Wednesday, September 11th, we've got the guys from Ari coming on to talk about all of their new accessories and also the Alexa LF and the Mini LF, which I know I have not had my hands on, but I am so excited to learn about it on September 11th over at Rule. Now, here's the thing. The pub night begins at 6 o'clock. That's the free pub night with pizza and beer. But before that, they're going to talk just about accessories, and that's from 3 to 5. So if you have from 3 to 8 available, you're going to get the advantage of learning all about the accessories and the LF and mini LF. So there is so much going on, and it's all free. They're going to talk about lenses too. So everything you need to know about what's going on in the ARRI world right now is happening on Wednesday, September 11th, over at Rule Boston Camera. The way to RSVP is go to rule.com, rule.com/events. Click on the event and you will let them know that you'll be there. I'll be there. So I'll see you guys there, September 11th. That's a Wednesday night. All right, let's get to our interview with Matt Eberhard, the director of photography for Our Planet. So I'm here with Matt Eberhard, wildlife cinematographer, and so excited to talk to you about how you create these stunning and amazing shots that I've been seeing when I'm prepping for this interview. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, I'm really grateful for the opportunity, actually. It's great to talk about it. You know, I'm often in the field, Ben, remote from people and in fact, anything apart from animals and trees it's nice to be able to talk about my work a little bit.
We've done like over 170 episodes, and I don't think we've ever had specifically a wildlife cinematographer before. So I'm excited to hear, you know, how you even got into this industry, because it seems niche, but maybe to you, it isn't. So where did it start for you?
Well, it started for me. I think if you're in film, obviously you have to have a passion because, you know, filmmaking is about making, telling stories, correct?
Of course.
I mean, my passion is, wildlife. And I started from that point of view. So really filmmaking was a way of me supporting that interest. And I think I share that with everyone I work with. There is no way that you can be a wildlife cinematographer or be involved in wildlife filmmaking unless you're interested in the subject matter. Mm. In the same way that, you know, you can't be a feature film cameraman unless you're interested in feature films. These, you know, careers, these creative careers are, I think, driven by passion. That's why we do what we do. We're incredibly lucky to be involved in a business that supports our personal interests. And I think, that's my standpoint on it.
Being involved in the film and creative industries is so privileged when you really think about it. I mean, we have so much fun at our jobs and it could be so much worse. And it's like to even complain for 2 seconds is ridiculous, but I still would complain because I'm a complainy type.
But, well, I think, complaining is part of it perhaps as well. You know, I mean, we have this reputation of being incredibly patient people, but, mm-hmm. but actually really we're bloody minded and we're driven people who charge out there, in the pursuit of a shot. It's a job, you know, it's a passion, it's a job, and it comes with all sorts of frustrations, all sorts of joy. I spend a lot of time, you know, working in East Africa, and I always kind of look at it as like a bit of an East African road. You know, you drive along for hours and days and you're bumping along and it's hard and it's, you're breathing dust and you're hitting holes in the ground. And then suddenly, you know, you crest a ridge and you get just this amazing view of this moment of beauty that you can hold in your hands. And I think that's what filmmaking is to me. And everyone that I work with shares that.
I want to focus on Our Planet, which is the work that I've seen of yours, the Netflix series. The cinematography in this show is absolutely gorgeous. And I know you're one of many. One of many cinematographers, one of many crews across the series. But can you just tell us a little bit about what the series is to just get everybody up to speed?
It is an absolutely brilliant wildlife series in the tradition of the best wildlife programming. But it has a different edge. It tries to, you know, bring beauty to the screen, but it doesn't shy away from actually some of the realities that we're finding as filmmakers now. It is our planet. Our planet nurtures us all, basically. And, what this series does is it tries to bridge that separation that we impose on the natural world. We're part of it, I think, and we need to recognize that. It's groundbreaking in that sense, I would say.
How long was the production for the series?
It was years. It's always been there for me. It seems that way when I look back at it. It's a multi-year effort that involves, you know, huge amounts of investment and time. These things aren't put together in months. These are year efforts, basically.
Now, you spent a lot of your time in the jungles for the sequences that I saw of yours, the Birds of Paradise, the orangutans, stuff in the jungle. Of course, you also did the flamingos, in episode one, but I want to focus our attention in your jungle experience for a while here. Let's talk about Birds of Paradise to start. When I looked at this clip, I thought to myself, I mean, orangutans certainly would be difficult to shoot, but birds, I mean, they're just the slightest noise and they fly away, you know? And they move so quickly and just having to capture them moving and not have them know you're there. It's astounding to me that this can even happen.
It is astounding, and it's an amazing experience when you're, you know, in a jungle and you have that intimate relationship with a subject that you've cultured over a period of time. You know, I mean, I think jobs in jungles are very varied. It's like, you know, on a film set, you have a whole different range of shots and different subjects, and each subject demands a different approach. So in this particular context, these birds are shy. They don't like a camera poked in their face. You have to, you know, do a lot of investigative work, you know, getting, finding the right place, right time, building blinds that you hide in all day. It's intensive, but incredibly focused on an incredibly small area. These courts that the Birds of Paradise, you know, build in the forests of New Guinea, are, you know, they're a couple of meters across in diameter. And obviously the views into them are often quite tricky, because that's one of the biggest problems with filming in jungles, is to try to get the view. But in order to get close to a bird that is the size of a jay, let's say, you know, in order to get those frame-filling images, which is what this is really all about, it requires a series of sort of strategized moves. So you bring the camera close to the bird in stages, and then, you know, you're a participant in this amazing bit of drama that unfolds in front of you. It's a remarkable feeling. It's definitely not for everyone, though. This is you have to be kind of obsessed to put yourself through this, I think. You know, you really do.
So what is your prep like? So how does it work? Does your production company tell you, okay, you're going to be going into the jungles, you're going to be shooting Birds of Paradise. What happens from that point on?
Yeah, basically. There is a team of people back in Bristol, at the company I work for, Silverback Films. They have the best researchers, they have the best producers, they have, you know, a huge number of people working on just these problems. You know, where do we go? At what time do we go? You know, what are the most interesting stories in wildlife? How can we tell this story with, you know, a bird or an animal? And so they nail all that down, you know, which is brilliant for me, because basically I just get to go on safari and have a great time. And I don't really have to do anything other than focus when I get there. The story briefs can be quite, let's say, I wouldn't say vague, but, you know, we always go out for a piece of behavior, which is our principal objective.
Sure.
But that behavior is not predictable. So we have to, you know, be attuned to situations that we find in the field and be reactive to that.
What was the behavior you were going after in that sequence? The one in particular that I think is really the most interesting to watch is the Western Parotia, I think.
Yes.
Am I saying that right? Describe to us what event was going on, and then we'll talk about how you captured it.
So the Western Parotia, it used to be called the Six Wired Bird of Paradise, which is a much nicer name, I think, much more evocative. I mean, this is a crazy jungle bird. It's the size of a jay. It's a beautiful bird that essentially produces and makes a dance floor in the middle of the forest, and it goes through this series of gestures to court females and attract them down to a spot in the forest where it basically shows off. So it's an incredible creature. That is highly complex, that's unbelievably beautiful. It's what do I say? I'm a bird guy. I just love it.
I can tell.
I just love it.
You know, I am not, but you can't help it when you watch this series to kind of become obsessed with these animals, because just watching them do their things are so interesting. Like this moment that we're talking about here, it sort of cleans its area. It gets rid of all the leaves. And the voiceover tells us that that's because the females want to only go where it is the cleanest spot. So it's preparing its area. It does this amazing dance. It does all these interesting flourishes. Its eyes flash to yellow, which I thought was really interesting. And there was all these little details happening. And I thought to myself, how can you possibly be shooting this without them either noticing you or caring that you're there? And I wanted to dive into that a little bit. So you know you need to shoot this event. What's your process like actually getting to the spot and setting up and preparing for the shot?
So I was one of three people working on this. And we were in New Guinea. We had a series of courts that were identified by a local Papuan who really, you know, lives birds too and has done culturally. The Papuans are incredibly interested in birds because they've hunted them, and the plumages of these particular birds form part of ceremonial headdresses. So basically, we had that local knowledge, and we went into the forest and we mucked around, basically investigating, looking at our options, and decided how we were going to approach each individual court, each individual dancing court, how we would position blinds made from local materials, actually, so that they really blended into the forest matrix, in order to get the key angles, because the birds of paradise go through these the stages in the courtship, so it's quite regimented, and each part of the display occurs in a different part of the court. So, you build the sequence basically gradually by getting key shots. And obviously you're not limiting yourself when you're in the field to one particular, camera position. Good photography, not just good wildlife photography, but good photography in my book is about moving the camera and never getting locked in. And that is actually one of the biggest dangers, that you can be so captivated by the action that you forget to actually, shift the camera down a foot or move it to the side, or say to yourself, look, we got this shot now. We have to move the blind. We have to move our camera. And if you don't do that, then of course you can't cut a sequence, because you need all your different angles. That's part of the approach. And as you're working on these events, as you're building your confidence with the bird, and the bird is also building its confidence with you because it kind of knows you're there, you can start to take more liberties in the way that you move yourself and position yourself to get the action. I mean, actually, the key problem with Birds of Paradise was not the males who were the court owners, because they got quite interested in, they're quite locked in, and they're invested in this place, So you can actually, get away with quite a lot. It's the females that are coming down to this court, and of course, the females have choice, which is what these displays are all about. And so if the females are uncomfortable with something that you've put in place, then you've got problems. So that's the key.
That's interesting. So they are aware that you're there, even with the screens up. They just know something's going on.
Yes, and I think they have their own triggers for predation. I mean, if I happen to look like a forest hawk, they wouldn't be staying around,
Yeah.
But I'm an eye basically onto their court, and everything that I do in that situation is about trying to be quiet, trying to give them that that space that they need to do their thing. So it's not a job for everyone. This is really not. You have to apply a dedicated focus, and you have to do a lot of waiting in this context. I mean, orangutans is totally different. Each job in the forest is totally different.
Sure.
Some require, waiting and strategy, and others are just about beasting it. It's about moving and following, and it's like, you know, you're in a jungle warfare training camp. I mean, it's that simple.
What kind of
so
a crew?
There's no one size fits all.
Yeah. What kind of a crew are you traveling with?
Well, I work very closely with a producer director called Hugh Cordy, who's a great guy. He and I, you know, enjoy working together in the field. We have usually, you know, a local, either researcher or, in this case, in Papua New Guinea, a local man who came from a hunting tradition, and he now makes his living taking bird watchers on safari. You know, so it's really, you know, incredibly small, dedicated teams. And I think that's a key point. That, you know, everything about wildlife film is about field time. They're every bit of a budget is about getting camera people into the field. I mean, across the series, I think it was like 3,500 field days. You know,
wow.
With about 40 camera people, you know, working on this production. And you can bet your life that Hugh and his colleagues have really looked at each particular shoot and said, you know, look, how can I get Matt into the field for another 2 or 3 days here? Mm. Or how, you know, can Alistair be given more time to, you know, apply himself to this particular macro sequence? When you're filming wildlife, you're spending huge amounts of time planning, waiting, fighting, and each shoot will doubtless pivot on one or two key moments. And of course, you know, we still need luck, but we make our luck by, you know, dedicating ourselves and making sure that we're in the field for the right time at the right place. And we make sure we're fresh enough to actually get it when it happens.
So for this Birds of Paradise sequence, how many people were with you? Sounds like you were shooting your camera. You had a producer. Do you have an AC with you?
No. Yes, actually, sometimes. Toby Nolan in this context. So yes, an AC helping us move kit around, looking at rushes with us. Because the review process is always really important. You know, do you have it or do you not have it? You know, do you need to, you know, repeat that shot or can you move on? Can you move on? Can
sure.
you move on?
Yeah, yeah.
And then because, you know, what we present in the movie is a composite of several courts. We're covering several different courts with another couple of people. So a guy called Tim Lamarn, who's a very famous stills photographer and is doing great, great video too now, was involved in this shoot. And Ed Scholes, who is a bird behavior expert, was also shooting. So it was a collective effort, basically, you know, to produce a composite that actually sells this forest and this bird, and its incredible beauty. That's what it's all about.
Do
it's
you
a
have
passion business.
Do you have multiple angles at the same time going?
Sometimes, yeah, and of course that makes it very easy. But you always have to balance that with, you know, the possible disturbance factor that you bring to the equation.
Sure.
You know, you really have to try to be the fly on the wall. You don't want to be a swarm of bees, put it that way. You know?
Yeah, well, something I found interesting about that sequence is you had an overhead shot. And
yes.
I was thinking, just where did you even get that camera stuck to? Was it just tied to a tree or how did you do it?
It's just tied to trees, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you always have to be creative. I mean, you know, when you're filmmaking, you know this. You just got to get out there and it's about putting the camera in the right place. And you do whatever you can to effect that. And in this context, we had a Canon stills camera that was controlled remotely and that was positioned over the court and moved into place. It was camouflaged. It was, you know, covered in camouflage wrap. But you know, it was just presented to the bird and the bird got used to it. Mm. And then we would move it and get closer and be more adventurous. So as the bird gains confidence, we're able to get away with more. You know, the key thing is that you obviously don't want to disturb any of this, because you know, if you're tasked with getting animal behavior, you really don't need the bird looking at the camera or flying away.
Sure, yeah,
I mean, it's that obvious. But I think, you know, every single wildlife filmmaker out there and every wildlife show, but particularly our planet perhaps, we've pushed the boundaries of wildlife filmmaking. And a team of experts has pooled their knowledge and to pull this off. I mean, it's an incredible bit of TV.
Let's take a moment and talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Now, Magnanimous Rentals is a production equipment rental house. It's based in Chicago, but they ship anywhere in the country. And they've got a fantastic inventory. But where they really shine is their prices. Their prices are amazing. They just can't be beat by anybody. Now, even their regular prices are amazing. But then on top of that, they have these things called flash discounts. And these are items, they're flashing red, they're right there, bold, right in your face. And sometimes the flash discounts are as much as 50% off, but it's only for a limited time. So you have to book these items during the flash discount while it's happening. And there's a little countdown there so you know how much time you have. Now, flash discounts don't go on forever, so you need to check the website every single day over at magrents.com. And lastly, let's talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers and basically has completely changed the way that I do my backups on set. I mean, before Hedge, I was just dragging files all over the Finder, and that's really not the best way to do it. Hedge is a professional software. You have the peace of mind of knowing that the backup you're making has been done correctly and at the best and highest speed possible. So Hedge lets you import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So I'm always going to have a couple of camera cards, an audio card. You know, sometimes even a behind-the-scenes photographer will give me their cards. So I have all of those sources, and I plug them all in, and they're right there on the left-hand side of the app. And then I set my destinations. Now, I like to have two backups before I leave set. Not just one, but two. So I've got my two hard drives there. I press transfer, and it just goes. It just goes. I don't have to think about it. Plus, if I have the Hedge Connect app for my phone, which I do, it'll give you a notification when the transfer is done. So you get peace of mind knowing it's done correctly. You can do it all at the same time, and it's done super, super fast. And that's just one of the many benefits that Hedge has. There's too many to mention, but if you go to hedge.video/go-creative-show, two things happen. One, you can learn all about what Hedge is about and learn all the little details and the features that it has. But also, you get 20% off the price of the full license, which is awesome. So head over there, hedge.video/go-creative-show, and check it out for yourself. It's time to use professional software for your backup management. And it's all there at hedge.video. So you get everything in there, and it sounds like you're saying that you let the bird get used to it, and then you move closer and closer. How long does that process take to get to the position where you're really ready to shoot?
Sometimes you're very lucky, and sometimes, you know, the animals or the birds are very tolerant. I mean, incredibly tolerant. Hmm. I think you know, as we work in today's world, we have perhaps less places to actually go and explore because of the state of our Earth. But, you know, oftentimes the animals are exposed to us. I mean, for example, the orangutans, they've been followed by a team of researchers for a number of years. So they're used to people. Hmm. And that's a key difference, actually, because 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, whilst there were many more orangutans, there were no tame orangutans or no habituated orangutans, which is why, in a sense, if you watch a wildlife film from the 1950s, you will see the cheetah running away. You know, that's the only shot people could get because they couldn't get anyone near them.
Yeah.
You know, so really, the subjects that we film are often in some ways quite used to people. And that's a huge advantage. But, you know, there are times when that's not the case and you're still pursuing, you know, something that is incredibly rare or pressured. I mean, I think working in jungles these days, you always get the sense of a squeeze. You know, one of the most ubiquitous sounds in the forest these days, anywhere, in any forest around the world, is a chainsaw. You know, you're never really launched into the middle of nowhere. That's an advantage and also a crippling disadvantage too.
You had to put, are we talking hours, days, minutes to just kind of get yourself into the space and get the animal acclimated? And I'm sure everyone is different, but I'm just, you know, having no idea what the process is like. Well, is it multiple days or?
Well, let's say, you know, if there are 40 camera people, men and women working on this, there are about 3,500 field days across the series. There's 50 countries, you know, in every continent. And basically, I think the average, you know, is about 10 days per minute of screen time. Mm. Now that's the average. I reckon my shoots are like 6 weeks for 3 minutes or 4 minutes. So
either that means 6 weeks for 3 minutes.
I must be given all the really, really difficult shoots. It's like, oh, who's going to do that? I know Matt would do that. You know, Matt's an insane person. You know, I mean, he's up for a challenge. And I get sent to these places where perhaps we have to squeeze every last drop out of the cameraman.
So
it takes time. It's time intensive, and that's again, it feeds back into this idea that, you know, you can't be a wildlife filmmaker, you can't be a documentary filmmaker, let's say, if unless you have that passion for your subject.
Unless you're insane. Is that what you're saying?
unless you're insane. Yes. And actually, it helps if you're insane as well. Which clearly I am. You know,
Just to like localize it to just one event, that Birds of Paradise event that we were talking about, the Western Parodia, how long was that entire process from start to finish for you?
That was like, I think it was a 6 week shoot.
Six weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks of trekking around in the forest and getting rained on and sitting in a small hide. But, you know, these blinds that we were using in Papua were like luxury accommodations. I mean, you could actually stretch out in them. You know, a blind sit could be from, you know, dawn to dusk is normally dawn to dusk. They can be quite cramped and miserable experiences, really, when you're, you know, sort of... There was a medieval torture device called Little Ease, which was basically a cage where people were put and they weren't let out. And sometimes I think to myself, well, hey, this is what it's like. I've got cramp, I'm really fed up, I'm cold. There's nothing I can do. I can't leave because I don't want to disturb my subject. And I put 2 or 3 weeks into this, so I just got to sit it out. But you know, it can be quite difficult when you're, you know, stuck in cramped, dark quarters and the mosquitoes just landed on your nose and you've lined up a shot, but you can't swat it away because you don't want to introduce camera shake.
Oh my God! This is exactly what I wanted to talk about because it's all the logistics stuff that I'm so blown away by. Like, where are you sleeping when you do this? Are you sleeping right there?
Yeah, I just sleep in the forest, mate. We just sleep in the woods. I mean, some jobs, I literally do that and bivvy down. I just got back from a shoot in South Carolina, and I was basically sleeping out on a beach for 3 weeks. But hey, no hardship there, right? No, I mean, we got to review rushes. That's the big thing, you know. You go out, you spend your whole day. Then you have to look at what you've got because you've got to plan what you're going to do the next day, or at least have an idea of where you're going with this. And you've got to be able to find those holes and say, okay, you know, I have this shot. Now, what do I need to do to make this work? Or do I need to spend more time and giving an editor variety here? Because isn't that what it's about? When you're a camera person,
yeah,
you're about actually, your job is not so much to direct, although directing in wildlife camera work is incredibly important. But your job is to actually provide an editor and your producer director with choices.
Sure.
And so in order to do that, the review process, you often have to, I mean, you really basically have to have a secure place where you can take your footage, you can download it, you can review it, you can have a good meal, you can clean yourself up, you can clean the camera, you know, you can stick it in a bag overnight with some silica gel, and you prepare yourself for the next morning's assault. Because if you don't have at least that, then it can get a bit much. I mean, we're gluttons for punishment because we like it, we soak it up. But man, there's nothing that beats, you know, a good dinner at the end of the day.
Oh my God!
And some amazing piece of tropical fruit, you know.
I mean, do you just have like one central location where you're staging your equipment, you're sleeping, you have your power?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So there will be a generator. You know, power is everything. That is perhaps one of the biggest problems with digital tech. I mean, I love digital technology. It's opened so many doors where, you know, the fact is that, you know, we've got this incredible whatever camera system you're using, it's all incredible now compared to film. But one of the big disadvantages of it, in a sense, is just that. It's incredibly power hungry. So when I cut my teeth on the plains of East Africa, you would, you know, we'd be shooting film. And a film camera, I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't heat up. And that is an advantage of film in the wildlife filming context. But digital tech requires power. You need to charge it up, and you need to have a lot of battery. It's because, you know, the camera is often in a standby mode. You can't expect to power up a RED, for example, and you've got to keep it running because, I mean, you know, what, 30 seconds to power up a RED or a minute these days? I mean, I don't know. It always annoys me whenever I switch it on.
Yeah.
You know, time is money, man. And you're always, well, when you're in that position, when you're filming, you know, you've got to capture these fleeting moments. You've got to be on the ball. So, you know, there's no point having a camera switched off. It's got to be there. It's got to be ready. It's got to be primed, and you've got to be primed. You know, you've got to be on the button, as it were, to pick up an event that you know can be repeated, but often isn't.
I can only imagine that being out there for 6 weeks with how little footage you actually get out of it, there must be days where nothing happens, where you just wait all day.
Absolutely.
I mean, is that more common than not?
Oh, absolutely. Every single shoot, I mean, speaking for the production as a whole, there will be a key moment or two. I mean, so in the Birds of Paradise sequence, you know, obviously it's all about getting a mating. I mean, this bird has got to go through its displays, but there has to be an end to that story. In the context of the orangs in Sumatra, you know, it's about getting an orangutan using a tool to probe out, to probe insects from an insect nest.
Yeah.
I mean, 6 weeks, maybe that happens three times. You've got to be beasting it, moving that camera around, following these animals that are just moving through the trees with a supreme fluidity. And there you are, you're on the ground, you've got the kit, you're struggling through vines, you're smashing yourself up, you're smashing the kit up, and you've got to be on the ball because that event, which you're there for, could be over like that. And if you missed it, then you're in trouble.
because you're going to go back empty-handed, and that means you're sacked. Basically, it's a delivery business. Put it that way. You've got to be on the ball.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And your producers must just know from their experience and maybe perhaps seeing these events before just where they happen, or do you truly just run blind?
Well, I think no, totally. It's all about planning. It's all about, getting the right information from the right people. And then a producer like Q, he will have a number of options in front of him, and he will weigh up, each option. How do I tell my story? How do I invest my money in this? What are the risks attached to this shoot, the physical risks? Can we justify getting a cameraman into this particular volcano, for example? Is it worth it? If we invest in a Western Protea sequence, how rare is the Western Protea in these remnant forests that are left now? Can we get a number of courts that we have a choice on, or will we be locked into just sort of like one, So it's all about balance, and it's all about, a targeted application of effort. Everything about, where do I do this? How do I do it most effectively? What is the story that I want to tell? And is this going to be value for money? And is it going to give good value on screen to, are people going to be interested in this? This is ultimately about entertainment, right? What I love about our planet is that it's beautiful and fantastic TV, but it is telling, story, and it is highlighting, some of the problems out there in the world too. So,
It absolutely is. And I think it has a lot of personality to it too. Like the voiceover and just the writing, it's really, really well done. I want to talk for a couple minutes about your equipment and what you're bringing out there. So what are the cameras that you're using?
Well, I'm sort of like locked into the red system, and I enjoy it, it's a modular camera. It basically is tough as well. I mean, I was initially very worried about, the Epic and the top plate and looking down into the bowels of the machine from the top. But, it performs pretty damn well in all sorts of, conditions. I mean, I've had my own personal Epic has been flooded by whales. It's been smashed up in dusty cars, it's pretty epic actually. But whether that's a better camera than an Arri, I mean, obviously we could talk for hours about the technology, but everything works really quite well these days. I mean, it's all about high dynamic range in my book, I come from a film background. I cut my teeth on film. I shot more 35mm wildlife film material than pretty much anyone out there, I think. And it's beautiful. But the reason why it is beautiful is because you can obviously, capture an image that retains value. I think that it's amazing what you can actually get away with these days digitally. When you're talking about the Birds of Paradise sequence, I mean, much of that was like two or even three stops underexposed or more. And yet you can still pull an image out of it. I think that's just incredible, to be honest with you. Yeah, it's just absolutely incredible what you can do.
Are you shooting 4K, 8K? What are you usually doing for resolution?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, we're given a brief. Obviously 4K is the standard, but oftentimes, particularly with red, you're going to want to shoot at different resolutions because, of course, the sensor size can limit your shot size. So certainly when I shoot for myself, I might well vary that resolution. But principally from the point of view of actually being able to get good wide coverage with my wide lens. I'm wanting to avoid that crop factor. If I shoot 4K, then obviously I'm cropping my sensor size. So often I might pull out and just say, okay, we need this wide, but I'm going to shoot it in 8K, not even for the resolution, but for the fact that, you know, actually I need a wide shot. When I'm working in the field, we can't go through endless lens changes. So we're often locked into a particular lens. I mean, for example, the 50-1000 as a Canon optic, which is really the standard lens now. I mean, that's an incredible range, but you still want to go as wide as possible sometimes. Mm. Or you want to go as tight as possible. And I think that's a real, well, that's a change as well as the industry has progressed and as we have these digital tools. You know, I can often, you know, pull out a little bit and frame a shot slightly wider than I might do if I was actually looking for that a particular tight image, because I know that, you know, it can be cropped in post. That's incredible. That's an incredible tool. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That especially with events that, you know, one might miss, you know, The impactful shots are the big wides and the close-ups. That's what it's all about. But sometimes you might frame a mid shot because you don't want to lose the action. But with the resolution that we're shooting at now, we can actually crop that image, or a producer in the edit can crop that shot and say, okay, we're going to make this more impactful. We want to get rid of that extraneous bump that's in the frame. Let's move in on this particular look or this particular eye, or, you know, and that's a joy, you know, that's a joy to be able to do that.
What are some of the considerations when you're selecting your lens, your camera, your, you know, your equipment package? Are you thinking about weight? Are you thinking about durability? What are some of the things that, you know, may be surprising to camera operators that are doing narrative work versus the stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, just strip it down to the basics. That's what I do. You know, I mean, different people have different approaches, right? But I find that really what a camera person should be doing, or a particular documentary camera person or a wildlife cameraman, should be focused on the image that they're bringing to the camera. You know, I love kit, but it's about the image. It's not about the kit. You know, there was an amazing shoot that I did a number of years ago that really brought it home to me. I was in Pennsylvania shooting elk rutting. And believe it or not, Pennsylvania is the place to go for that. Huh? Because you have, they reintroduced Western elk that roam in a few counties in Pennsylvania. And they have these amazing, you know, horn racks that they're incredible. And they're also quite tame, these animals. You can approach them. But I was there filming this absolutely unbelievable scene. It was coming into fall. These animals are rutting. There's this sweaty and muddy, you know, bull elk charging around, roaring. You can see the sort of spit coming out of its mouth.
Wow.
With unbelievably beautiful backlit foliage and spider webs, you know, drifting through the frame. And I mean, it was priceless, and it was backlit and, you know, in wonderful soft light. And then on the horizon, the group of amateur photographers, you know, would walk behind and into my frame, and they were all shooting with the sun behind them. There was about 30 of them, you know, just shooting with the sun behind them, killing any resolution in their cameras. And the topic at the end of the day was, you know, God, what does my camera do? And, you know, what lens was I using? And yeah. And I just thought to myself, you're not seeing the wood for the trees, man. You know nothing about photography.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't care if you've got like 8K resolution or 60 megapixels, you know, with your camera. If you're not shooting and you're not involving shadow, your resolution is not even 2K. You know, let's cut to the chase. That's the reality, right?
Yes. Huh? Yeah. Huh?
Yeah. You can't see a backlit, you know, hair, and you're not framing a portrait for that. Then, oh my God. I'm sorry. I get depressed about it. I'm annoyed. I'm annoyed.
It is still annoys you to this day.
It annoys me. Yeah. Every day I go to bed and I think about it, and I think about those guys and how they're missing it. And maybe you should devote a whole, you know, page on your website, you know, basics, you know, good photography, what we do.
Well, people bypass the basics, I think, because they already own cameras. They're in their phone. They're just there. Like you just, having easy access is fantastic, but I think it also makes you feel like you can just, you know, consider yourself a professional if you haven't really had any training, which is good and bad, I think. I think there's...
Well, I think that you're totally right about that because, you know, obviously this is technology that's available to everyone. You know, whether you're using a GoPro or a, you know, high-end stills camera or, you know, an absolute top-of-the-range, you know, Red Maestro kit or whatever, it's actually available. You know, when I started in this business, you had to basically get a bank loan to get a camera.
Yeah.
And then once you got the camera, how are you going to get film? And then when you got film, how are you going to develop it? I mean, it's just insane amounts of money. And those barriers now have come down for everyone. But, you know, let's start with that. Like, you are not a camera person because you own a Red. You are not a stills photographer if you own, you know, a Canon, you know, top of the range Canon. You're a photographer if you apply yourself to a story and if you make the best use of light. And that's what photography is. It's about framing and trying to capture ephemeral moments and make them beautiful so that they sing. And that's what our planet does, man.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called With You All the Way by Ben Biney. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Head over to premiumbeat.com and you'll get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. $49! And it's not just the single track. You get cutdowns, you get loop sets, you get stems. And what that really means is you're able to customize the track to fit your project perfectly. But it's all about quality, and that's what you're going to find over at Premium Beat. So head over there, check out this track, and explore the others. PremiumBeat.com. And before we get to the conclusion of our interview with Matt, I want to talk about Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock is where you go, obviously, for music and for photos and for stock video and all sorts of stuff. They get a great blog. We've talked about that quite a bit. But they have something new. They recently introduced Elements, which are thousands of cinema-grade video effects for filmmakers like us. These are blockbuster quality video effects. This is not anything crappy. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is the best of the best. They're shot by industry professionals, and they include things like 4K lens flares, transitions, video kits with like smoke and fire and explosions and all sorts of stuff. So it's perfect for the professional. It's also perfect for people like me that just kind of want to dabble in visual effects, but I'm certainly not doing it at a professional level, that's for sure. I'm always going to hire somebody to do my visual effects because I can't do it. But what I can do is play around with these Shutterstock elements and have a ball doing it. So I suggest you do the same. No matter where you are, high-end professional or a little amateur like me when it comes to video effects, visual effects, Elements are for you, and they're priced right. They're really, really high quality. You get a ton of them. They're absolutely gorgeous. And they're all there over at Shutterstock.com. So you go to the website, you hover over footage and go right down to Shutterstock Elements and play around. I know you're going to love what you see over there. Shutterstock.com. All right, let's get to the conclusion of our interview with Matt Eberhard, the director of photography for Our Planet. You had mentioned shooting on those Canon 50 to 1000s. Never used one, but I can only assume they're heavy. And I'm thinking, how much weight are you traveling with? Is that something you need to consider? Like, are you got to have the lens you got to have, but are you trying to keep yourself as light as possible wherever possible?
Yes, I think you have to. But again, it depends on the subject. You know, if you are out there in Sumatra filming orangutans in a jungle swamp forest, you know, even with help, you are shifting gear around, and it's a killer. I mean, it is like jungle warfare. It's the closest thing you can come to jungle warfare. Instead of a machine gun and a tripod, you're carrying around, you know, an O'Connor on some Romford sticks and a camera and a, you know, 50 to 1,000 lens. That's heavy gear, man. You know, and it's not going to be working if it's in a pack either. That's the thing. You've got to have it out. You've got to carry it. It's got to be accessible because every single shot you're fighting for it. And you might be like 2 seconds behind it, but if you're 2 seconds behind that orang as it reaches out its hand and grabs a branch, you have missed that shot. So you know, it's a struggle with heavy gear. The payoff, of course, is that when it does work, you know, it is steady. When it does work, you have found that little hole in the canopy and you've extracted an image from it, you know. And whereas obviously if you're just, you know, around with a lightweight video camera, you know, a consumer camera with a short lens, you're going to get everything, but you're not going to make an image jump out of the screen.
We talked a little bit about this earlier, and I just wanted to just dig a little bit deeper into it, but tell me about your DIT media workflow. How is it working for you on set?
It doesn't work for me. Usually, I basically get the images and then I would hand over to an AC.
Sure, sure.
And I would say, here's my red card.
Yeah.
You know, offload it. I don't care what happens to it from there.
honest answer. I like it. Well, yeah. You got other things to think about.
You know, I do really always hope for, you know, solid state drives whenever I'm out in the field because, you know, you don't want to be downloading a card and it takes you an hour.
Yeah.
Not when you've been out all day and where you actually feel the need, the necessity to look at that material before you go to bed, you know, you don't want three hour, you know, download for the day's work. So solid state drives makes a massive difference, massive difference. And also I would say being conscious of what you shoot is also a really important part of that whole process. Because you want to minimize your effort, you know, downloading. You don't want to be stacking up drives. So if you're putting something onto that card, just at least make sure you think there's a use for it. And so there we are. It's a practical application.
Sure.
Trying to optimize your kit in the field, and all of these things play a part, don't they? It's not just about the camera. It's about how you're using the camera.
How are you monitoring?
I just shoot through an eyepiece, basically.
Really?
I mean, some of my colleagues shoot off monitors. I don't because I come from a film background.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware that if I'm laying down a fat signal onto the card, then I'm okay. So often I might push it a little bit, you know, I might push it towards overexposure because I know if I'm holding a shot, then maybe that's a good way of reducing grain. But oftentimes also I'm just shooting with what I have. And I'm trying to make the best use of what I have. And that might not be a lot, you know. Do you send out
like a wireless signal to anybody else watching or is anybody else watching what you're seeing?
Oftentimes, no. It's the answer there.
So the first time anybody sees anything is when you're going through media at the end of the day.
Yes, and that's why the review process is so important.
Ah,
you know, because if you like, I mean, and perhaps it's because I come from a film background, I know what shots are going to work. You know,
yeah.
I've actually pre-selected it. You know, there's a beautiful shot. you know, it's half an hour after the sun has risen. I've managed the contrast in that image, so I'm happy with it, but I managed that contrast through my positioning of my camera and my subject, right? And I shoot, and I know I've got it. That comes from that film process where you knew an emulsion and you knew what your camera was capable of, and you filmed it, and then you waited for 3 months before you actually saw it, you know. Because the film had to go back from Africa to the lab in London, then it had to be processed, and then it had to be dumped onto a video, and then that video had to be sent back to Africa, and then it had to be sent out into the field. So I mean, knowing your kit, you know, is important. Each camera out there has its own capabilities and its own quirks. And you know, I mean, speaking personally, I like to shoot, you know, red because I'm used to it now. I know what image I'm getting. And I know if there's going to be a problem. Well, I have to weigh it up. I have to say, is this shot irrepeatable? You know, do I really need to shoot this shot in spite of the fact that technically it's going to be absolutely rubbish, right?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then I'll shoot it because, you know, it could be the one opportunity you have to get this particular image. But if it's repeatable, then I'll leave it and I will shoot it when it's repeatable and I'll get the best light possible on it and I'll wait for my moment.
Are you shooting with the Red RAW codec?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, it's incredible what this technology does. You don't have to overplay it or overanalyze it. It's incredible. The tools are incredible.
Yeah, they really are. Especially, I mean, where you started in film. I mean, you've seen so much change in the industry, and it's interesting to hear that you're right in there in the eyepiece. No one's getting a feed. They're trusting you as a camera operator to do this. You know, nowadays it's very different. There's monitors everywhere. Everybody's got a monitor. Everybody's got a comment, you know, there's something kind of, there's something appealing and freeing about that.
Yes, definitely. And that's why, you know, I've had my odd throw in the feature world and not completely successfully, I would say. You know, I understand that a feature film set is a different thing. You know, you've got lots of people all doing this incredibly brilliant specialist jobs. But I would prefer to strip it away as much as I can. Because I think that the more people you have, the more disturbance you're making in a forest. The more people you have, the less field days you've got.
Yeah.
You know, and let's face it, good photography is about waiting for that moment. And that's what our planet does. It brings these moments to people that are priceless and beautiful.
Do you capture sound at all, or is everything done in post?
Most of it's done in post. Simply because you can't do too much.
Yeah.
But of course there are times when you can run sound too, brilliant to be able to, you know, jam sync time code to a recorder that you can actually just, you know, control from a position in a blind, even though your microphone, your recorder are like, you know, 30 foot away from you. I mean, that just wouldn't have happened with a Nagra, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, tech helps, you know, it's a joy to use, you know, but finding the application for it is the key thing always. And a wildlife soundtrack is constructed because you can't do everything in a set that you cannot control.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, look, we tried to find a quiet room for this interview, and I know I'm in LA and I'm like a fish out of water here basically, but everywhere I hear the sound of traffic.
Yeah.
I can't go anywhere without hearing the sound of traffic. And actually that's one of the major problems with a lot of wildlife filming now is that, you know, the places that we're going to are fractured, and they are not contiguous. There is always that person there in the background. There's always, for example, in the forest, the chainsaw is the most ubiquitous sound in the forest.
Wow.
You know, so how can you build that soundscape with all of that going on? You could argue that actually perhaps our planet is a first step, and that we need to be even more honest in our portrayal of the natural world, because it is so threatened and at risk. It's difficult to get a soundtrack that's pure because we are there.
What would you say is the most dangerous situation you've ever been in while shooting wildlife?
Anything that involves elephants can be quite hairy. It's a difficult question because we measure risk in different ways, don't we? My dad, you know, I mean, he's a great guy, and he gets really worried when I go off to Alaska and I film bears, and I say, Dad, it's not the bears, it's the flight to the bloody islands. You know? It's like, you know, your perception of it is different. You're seeing this crazy toothed, you know, mental animal, but actually all it wants to do is to eat sedge, you know. Here it is, it's a bear, you know, it wants to eat sedge grasses, it grazes, it's like a giant cow with hair, but getting there, that's dangerous.
Have you ever been attacked, or have you had animals storm toward you?
I've been threatened by a big silverback gorilla in Cameroon.
Oh my God!
And that's like a heart stopping moment, but it's something I always hold. You know, I just live for those sort of things. To be honest with you, it's wonderful when you can feel that small, and thank God we can.
Mm. In our last couple of minutes, I want to just get some advice for filmmakers that are listening that really want to get into this industry. I mean, it's not something you can just go to school for. This is something you really have to apply yourself in different ways than other types of filmmaking. So what do you say to those people that want to get into this industry?
I think if you want to get into this industry, and I'm talking not just about wildlife filmmaking, but any filmmaking, any sort of documentary filmmaking, you just got to love it. And as we are saying, the tech brings, you know, it's the access point is open to everyone. So if you're interested in a film, get out, give it a go. And, you know, be conscious of the fact that your work can always be improved, whatever it is. You know, there is no good cameraman out there who's ever really satisfied with what they've done. I maintain that, you know, you've always got to be looking to improve your work and critique it and be honest with yourself. I think that's the thing. This is a creative business. You know, everyone is able to do this. So be honest with yourself. How good are you at this? You know, what is your own particular voice? What skills can you bring to this, you know, this picture? And look at it as a big learning experience, because, you know, that's what it is. It's learning. Every day is learning.
I love that. I think that's great. But and that's all perfect. But so somebody's listening, they're like, I do love it. I do want to do this. But what like, where do you actually go? Are there resources online? Are there mentorship programs? Is there any, you know, production houses you can intern for? Like, where do people go for wildlife cinematography,
to get into wildlife photography? Okay, start reading your books. Start going out, you know, into the backyards, you know, into your backyard. Start, you know, getting out there and absorbing, you know, the beauty that is on your doorstep. Go to the various wildlife film festivals that are, you know, are there where you can see, you know, people's work showcased. Go and, you know, write letters, meet people, shoot, you know, don't say do. You know, if you want to get into wildlife film, go and make a movie about how a leaf drops off a tree. You know, take a simple subject and shoot it well, and use that as an illustration of your abilities, and then get it out there. Get it out there. Go and talk to people, you know, and post it online and take advantage of all these wonderful opportunities that are out there for people these days. You know, just do.
Yeah, like I imagine the most important qualities in a wildlife cinematographer is obviously being able to compose a shot and all the basics of photography. But I guess in your work, you're proving that you know which moments to capture, and just your ability to be there when something's happening.
Yes,
and probably understanding light, because you can't bring your own, so you need to work with what you have. And maybe those are them, but are there any, like, what are the qualities that a wildlife cinematographer should really hone?
Your bloody-minded determination to do a job and do it better.
Patience and perseverance. I'm catching a theme from you, Matt. I really am getting a theme from you.
Well, good, because that's what it's about. It's about perseverance, stupidity, culture. That you know, that never say die attitude. But in all seriousness, I think saying that you're going to do something is different from doing it. Mm. And now you can do it. The tech's there. You can go out. You can do it. So if you want to be a wildlife filmmaker, you shouldn't be writing to people and say, I want to do this. You should be writing to people and say, hey, look at what I've done. Mm. Do you think that this is worth anything? How can I improve this? You know, get it out there and be brave. It's as we said already several times, this is a passion business. Any documentary filmmaking is a passion business. So be passionate about it and make it happen for yourself. You know, it's possible. Get out there, get it done.
Our Planet is on Netflix. You guys should absolutely check it out. It is fantastic. And of course, you get to see Matt's work in there. Where can people go online to learn more about you, Matt? Do you have an Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff too? Or
just to be honest with you, something I need to do, really.
Oh my God, yeah. You should be showing behind-the-scenes stuff. Actually, on that note, there's a great behind-the-scenes on Netflix of Our Planet. It's like an hour-long feature about the making of it. And you're in it a lot.
I'm in it. Yeah. I mean, I have you seen it? You
know, I saw your parts.
You saw my parts.
I certainly did.
Which parts of mine did you see?
They have a lot of the jungle work.
Incredibly red legs.
I did see that. Oh my God, that looked painful. But yeah, I saw the. Yeah, I saw the jungle work. And what was that? Was that just like a rash or what? What was it?
It was a plant-based rash that unfortunately I was struck down by. In the jungles of Sumatra, and I had to take a couple of days out, which was very annoying.
So if nothing else, you've got to see Our Planet just because of look at what Matt's done to his body and his mind and his heart for you. Go and watch his stuff.
I'm going to be globally famous for having a really great pair of incredibly red legs. That's not so cool, really, is it? But there we are.
Anyway, oh my God!
Taken as a whole, the experience was a good one.
So other than
there were some miserable moments.
I can imagine. Oh man, we have run out of time, but now you dangled that carrot in front of me. So you got to give me a miserable moment. You got to give me at least one that we can end the show with.
A miserable moment.
Well, that
was it. You know, just lying, you know, flat out, you know, in the jungle camp of Sumatra, watching my legs boil and fester, my flesh falling off. You know, as I was thinking about, you know, recovery. That's pretty miserable.
Do you have medics with you?
Or just recently, I was on a shoot. I'm quite good at filming flamingos, and there's an amazing lake in East Africa that's a caustic soda lake. So I actually had some blinds set up on these flats with my legs dangling in what is actually just like a caustic soda. So my flesh was literally, you know, rotting off my feet. I came back from this shoot 3 months ago, and I still got sores that have not recovered from that. So yeah, you know, it's all par for the course, though. You know,
what do you do if there is a serious medical problem? Like, do you have access to doctors and physicians and, you know, people, do you have to fend for yourself?
That's the great thing about working for a really great company is they do risk assessments, and every situation that we're placed in has been, you know, we're not just sort of like running and gunning it, put it that way.
Yeah.
So that's an advantage I have from the beginner out there. You know, I mean, a beginner might have to put up with more. We want field time. We want that camera to be running. We want to be onto that subject. There's no point taking silly risks. I've had been threatened by, you know, animals. I have been chased by hyenas. I have found myself, you know, stung up by, you know, hideous plants, and I've come close to a snake bite on occasion. So clearly things can happen in the field that you know you can't prepare for, and actually they could be quite catastrophic. But as I was saying, one's assessment of risk is based on experience, isn't it? I'm in LA. I'm lost in LA, right? I'm talking from me from LA. It's just like I get lost in car parks, you know. Yeah, it's a nightmare. You know, I'm not used. There are no straight roads in nature. So I'm actually more at risk in LA than I am in the Cameroonian forest.
Well, you are a unique breed, but we're glad that you're out there doing this work because it's fantastic, it's beautiful, and it's really the only opportunity that most of us are ever going to have to see, you know, these animals being themselves in their natural habitat. It's incredible work, and we're so thankful that you're out there doing it.
It's been great talking to you.
You too. Thanks for being on the show. Thank you for what you do and for sharing your experiences with us. And I'd love to have you back for your next project.
Thank you. Everyone, please enjoy our planet. It's groundbreaking and it's brilliant. And it's been a pleasure to work on that. So enjoy it. Do.
There he goes, Matt Eberhard, wildlife cinematographer. What crazy stories, huh? I mean, I can't even imagine doing half of the stuff that he's doing. I get annoyed if I don't have like the perfect temperature in the studio. I'm a diva. Our show would not be possible without Matt Russell, who mixes, masters, and makes this show sound so good. You can find him over at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. And also our producer, Connor Crosby. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. I want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Without those people, the show wouldn't exist, so please support those that support us. And lastly, follow us on all the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, we're all there at Go Creative Show. We always post our upcoming guests so you can ask them questions, and then we have your questions on our show. It's a great way to stay in touch with the show. We'll see you next week.